is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, the driver of a bin lorry that crashed in Glasgow in 2014, killing six people, has admitted reckless driving. It's after he was caught at the wheel of a vehicle 9 months later. Matt Steele has more.
Harry Clark's lorry careered into a crowd of shoppers when he passed out just days before Christmas. And despite admitting to an inquiry that he'd kept quiet about blackouts before, he was never prosecuted. But he did have his licence revoked for medical reasons months after the crash, and he was caught driving a car in the city in September 2015.
Tony Blair's calling on those who campaigned for the UK to stay in the EU to rise up and fight for what they believe in. The former Prime Minister says people who voted Leave last June didn't know the true cost of leaving. In a speech in London, he also claimed the government's sole focus is on Brexit. But Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who campaigned to leave, says he has no right to comment.
This is the guy who would have taken our country into the euro with what would have been catastrophic consequences. This is the guy who dragooned the United Kingdom into the Iraq War, with consequences foreign ministers are still trying to deal with.
The White House has denied reports the president is planning to use troops to round up illegal immigrants. The news agency AP says it's got hold of a draft memo which talks about mobilising as many as 100,000 members of the National Guard. Unilever has turned down what would have been the biggest ever takeover of a UK company. The firm, which owns brands including Persil, Marmite and Dove, declined an offer from Kraft Heinz. One of the Hatton Garden jewellery raid ringleaders admitted being involved in a previous burglary. Danny Jones has told a court he stole goods worth £1 million from a store in London in 2010. And Bournemouth have been charged by the Football Association for allegedly breaking its anti-doping rules. It's claimed the Premier League club failed to ensure the whereabouts of their players was accurate, but there's no suggestion of actual doping. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Live from inner city Bristol.
Keeping Bristol together.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we pay our taxes for the government to ensure there's an emergency where they're there. The cuts are about to hit Avon Fire Brigade, though. How will they affect what happens when we dial 999? Plus, a strange meeting indeed as Trump meets Netanyahu. And the Arab Spring, a psychological warfare operation cooked up at the Rand Corporation. That's what one whistleblower who used to work there says. He also believes the UBS in Switzerland, that's the bank, is the main conduit for secret funds from the West and the Gulf states to ISIS and other Middle Eastern terrorist groups, which means they're not really terrorists at all, just special operations by rogue states such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Kuwait. My acronym is PREFABS. We look at passwords last week and real privacy. But we'll do our best to run through them all for you tonight. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs up to 11, mainly cloudy with sunny spells. Without hardly any rain at all, it doesn't look like. Next week, highs of 11, again, mainly cloudy week with some sunshine and wet and windy weather, though, next week. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of February, highs 8, a bit cooler, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping to review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. But before we hear from Tim, an update again on our lack of MP guests over the last few months. Phone calls two this week I made to Bristol's three Labour MPs, East, Kerry McCarthy, South, Karen Smith and West, Thangam Debonair. A month on, still no reply from any of them. Some positive sounds, though, from Kingswood's Tory MP Chris Skidmore, and polite letters declining for the time being from Bristol North West MP Charlotte Leslie and Jack Lopresti from Filton and Bradley Stoke. But from Bristol Labour, an icy silence. I'll take the immortal words of advice from the former Lib Dem cabinet member Simon Cook and keep trying. Anyway, Tim Kent, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks, Tony.
First of all, can you give us a quickly your take on the missing £29 million?
Well, this week we've had the publication of the Bundred report. So this was an outside expert who was brought in to take a look at what happened. What he's found is, firstly, a systemic failure, really, within the council's finance department. Secondly, a cover-up, mostly by senior officers, into not wanting to tell senior politicians and councillors and the public the real state of the finances. And I think thirdly, a failure of the system by politicians, all politicians, but in particular the mayoral system, in asking those difficult questions, keeping an eye on the finances. And I think really what we've seen is the centralisation of power, and now the effect of that secrecy basically allows incompetence to breed.
Now, it sounds like you're pointing the finger at George Ferguson there, but we're joined on the line by George now. Hi, George. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Tim. Good to connect with you again.
So, incompetence at the top, too much concentration of power, so you weren't able to keep an eye on all this, and even if you did, you weren't telling.
Well, Tim would, wouldn't he? But I don't think that's anything to do with it. I mean, incidentally, the first I heard of this report was the afternoon before it was published, at midnight that day. I was never requested, that's why I didn't know about it, to come and give evidence, which is evidence that Mr. Bundred didn't think that I was at all involved with whatever he was saying. And to be honest, I think we seem to have moved into a state of review rather than progress. And it does smell of politics a bit, but it's all about how we it's about looking back. Incidentally, Mr. Bundred wrote the excellent report. I got nothing against Mr. Bundred. He wrote the excellent report that gave Green Capital the green light and said that you couldn't possibly come to any other conclusion. There's been a great success. And Tim, you know, and I've got a lot of time for Tim. I think he's a really good councillor. But Tim and some of his colleagues were, had a slight conspiracy theory about, again, missing millions. It's nothing to do with missing millions. There's nothing missing. All that's missed is the failure to cut as much as we were being asked to cut in order to not balance the books. The books are reasonably balanced, but in order to suit the government's agenda. Now, I mean, the irony is that we didn't cut as much as the government would have liked. The other irony is, Tim, and I think you know this, that if I'd followed your advice of freezing the council tax, we would be in a much, much bigger state, a much bigger and more difficult state than we're currently in. So nothing's perfect. I will take full responsibility for being where I was at the time. Nothing was hidden, not by me, and maybe some things were hidden from me. I don't, but nothing was hidden by me. So there we are.
Okay, George, I'll just let Tim respond.
Well, I think, just to be clear, I would never use the term missing millions. That isn't the issue here. The issue was that there was a large savings program which was not meeting its targets. This was known within the organisation but was not shared with councillors. And I also accept with senior figures, I think including George, probably was not fully aware. A lot of the finger pointing within the report is clearly at senior officers. My issue here, and I think the we do need to face, is the mayoral system concentrated power with one person, the mayor, and that meant that there was not the checks and balances that existed before. And I think this is the true weakness we see of the mayoral system. I'm not making this a personal accusation, it is actually a failure of the system, and that's why I believe quite strongly that we need to relook at that. We need to be a lot more open in how we do our governance. We need to rebuild trust. There was a lot of finger pointing and a lot of distrust over the last several years. Together we can make those difficult decisions, and we do need to make difficult decisions to balance the books. The reference, of course, to the council tax freeze is a little cheeky, because of course the cost of that was around £1 million, and we're now looking at £30 million overspend stroke failure to save.
Now look, George, one specific thing is we need to know from you, did you know that you personally, that this slippage, as you might politely call it, some might call it fraud or false accounting in some way, did you know that this was going on by the time you left office? Did you know that there was this hole in the accounts which wasn't apparently being presented to other councillors?
I certainly didn't know to that extent. I knew, and everybody knew. I mean, there was not a case of that there had been a failure to make as much savings in terms of jobs, which are the main money, in the change programme. Everybody knew that. I shared all the financial thinking with Jeff Gollop, my excellent deputy mayor, and with my cabinet. They were, across all the political parties. So there was nothing, as far as I'm concerned, there was absolutely nothing hidden financially. It was completely open. Now, it's disappointing to hear that gap is bigger, but I don't begin to buy into some conspiracy about it. I think it would have been preferable to have made the very ambitious savings that we were trying to have made in order not to have, in order to reduce the current problem. But I inherited a very, very similar situation. And I never complained about it. I just got on and did it. And
OK, look, George, let's move beyond this whole conspiracy thing. And, well, I mean, did you... were you actually aware of the financial situation? Because we've got this... Somebody in every city council, every council across the land has got their Section 151 officers, financial officer, who are supposed to present to the council as a whole and to you specifically what the state of the books is. And so did you know that we had this 29 million hole, as it now seems we had in the accounts?
No. I mean, I thought that there was a figure that was considerably less than half of that. But I mean, as I said, I don't think Mr. Bundry thought that I had any clue about it, because I wasn't even asked to give evidence, which is pretty clear indication that he didn't think that I was in any way involved.
Well, we're hearing a bit of evidence from you now, aren't we? Anyway, Tim, there are systems in the council to make sure that councillors are shown how much money's going out, where it's going, at what time, and that clearly didn't happen. I mean, who is our Section 151 finance officer, and have they been doing their job, do you think?
Well, we've just appointed a new Section 151 officer.
Ah, so the old one's gone.
The old one was an interim who replaced, I think, an appointment we'd had, but also replaced an interim before that. We've had several Section 151 officers, and this has been part of the problem, actually. It's been the churn in the senior officer positions.
I totally agree with you,
and I think this has meant people have come in, they've not even had time to get to grips with the financial situation, and then they're suddenly replaced. So we have a new Section 151 officer who admittedly has come in during the middle of this budget process. So we have a lot of sympathy for the role she now has to take. I would say, though, I am not confident at the moment that the systems are in place. I would say at the moment there is not the full sharing of information that we would hope. And I would say that actually when you read the report itself, it does state that councillors should not be confident at this point that the system can actually give correct answers. This is not all about people covering stuff up. It is also about a system, a financial system within the council being broken.
Yeah,
George,
but
hang on, George. I just want to pin you down, if I can, on why we've had this churn of very important figures. This Section 151 officer, I don't want to bore people to tears too much, but I mean, it's obviously a very key post. Why has there been so many changes, including one you were mayor?
I inherited interim everything, including interim chief executive, and I put a very strong team in place. And unfortunately, we did have you know. These are about individuals, about people, and you can't control the situation. And unfortunately, we did have a loss of two or three Section 151 officers. And that's not uncommon, but it doesn't help in terms of stability. And I think there were times when we found it difficult to get, you know, Jeff and I both find it quite difficult to get the required information. But I don't make excuses about it. All I do say is that I took the view is we are where we are when I came in. Let's look forward and see how we can put our finances in a strong position.
Well, I'll tell you one way we can do that, George, and that is to start using some of our reserves. Apparently, we've got something like £100 million sitting around in reserves. And it is a little bit like, I wouldn't say it's a national emergency, it's like a Bristol emergency. Rather than cutting back massive amounts of services, which are going to affect almost wholly the most vulnerable people across the city.
Reserves are there for a very good reason. I mean, Tim and I have had lively conversations about reserves. Reserves are there for very good reason, because you do get contingencies that can easily run into tens of millions in the city. Increasingly, we're looking at the possibility of natural disasters and things like that, but there are engineering works, there are things like that that we have to have reserves for. There's no, you know, it is very foolish to run down the reserves. But what I would say is that Mr. Bundry had introduced his report, I haven't got it in front of me, with saying that, you know, we mustn't lose sight of the fact the principal financial challenge that the City Council has is to do with the cut in central government funding. And I think that this discussion is a distraction from that. Local authorities are taking the brunt of the cuts nationally. And I think that is completely unfair. It's hitting some of the poorest. I did all I could to protect the poorer ratepayers at the time when we were having to put ratepayers, council taxpayers, at the time we were having to put council tax up by 2% a year and 4% in the last year. But I think it is vital that we all do what we can to stand up to central government. I did what I could in practice, but what I wasn't prepared to do was bust the council.
Okay, George Ferguson, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Bye, Tim.
Also, we've had in Bristol this week, Labour's John McDonnell, Shadow Chancellor. Apparently, Bristol's horrendous cuts are discriminatory against the city because it has a Labour-strong council, claims Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell. It's really picking up, I suppose, from what George is saying there about a lot of these cuts being really just Westminster passing the ball to local authorities who often aren't Conservative ones. The MP, who is considered one of the leader of leader Jeremy Corbyn's closest allies, was in Bristol as part the party attempted to drum up support ahead of a series of local elections. He said the £101 million of cuts Bristol was facing over the next 5 years were horrendous. Time and again, he said, we're seeing this government discriminate against areas with a Labour councillor or a mayor.
Well, government cuts certainly are the big pressure that councils face. There's no doubt about that. This coming year, we're facing around a £20 million reduction in government funding. Following years, it works out to roughly £10 million a year in government funding. We should be clear, though, that it's not just a reduction in money. It also is an increase in pressure on demand of services. So in particular around adult care and the needs of older people to be looked after. And then we see that impact onto the NHS, etc. So there are real pressures. That is true.
So how are councillors and the mayor fighting back? I know you don't speak for the mayor, but how are you fighting back against this?
Well, we have very little control, of course, over how government sets its funding. The Conservatives have a clear majority. They were very clear in the general election they were going to cut council funding. Strangely enough, the public, that's what they voted for. What our job now is to pick up the pieces to save as many services we can.
Well, Surrey County Council have got quite successful tactics, haven't they? They've said, well, we're going to have a referendum to up the council tax for everybody, which, of course, they don't really want to have these referendums, central government, and they've managed to get a better deal out of the government, it looks like, as a result of it.
Well, they had a better tactic. We're up to the point where they texted a Labour politician the dirty plan that they're put in
place.
Yeah,
but it seems to have worked. It doesn't look like they're going to have this referendum now. The government's had another look at the money and it looks like they're getting a bit more for social care.
Well, we don't know because the government have not yet actually published what money we're going to get. In fact, they're going to announce that virtually on the day that we hold our budget meeting. Most of the county councils have already set their budgets without actually knowing what the final figure is from government. If there is a change from what was agreed back in November, December next week, we will know that. That will become clear. And then, yes, you will be right. A dirty deal was done. As far as I'm aware, no such deal has been done, unfortunately, for Bristol. We have to deliver a budget that balances. That is a legal requirement. If we don't do that, the government will come in and simply cut services. But within this, there are choices. There are several budget amendments down next week, which Labour, who have a majority on the council, could choose to support. There's little pain behind those. They are fairly painless, but they will protect a lot of frontline services. So I hope Labour councillors will work with opposition councillors, vote for those amendments, which come from ourselves. I've got an amendment down, and also the Green Party have several amendments down, which could really help protect frontline services.
Martin, let's go back to John McDonnell's little visit to Bristol this week. What do you make? Is it because councils are Labour that they're getting cuts?
Well, I think this, if you look at this way, the standard spending assessment that funds local councils, I think the evidence is fairly clear that leafy suburbs have been protected from cuts and that inner city areas have definitely taken the brunt. And Bristol doesn't, somewhere in the middle of that, because it's a relatively prosperous city. But the stuff I've seen suggested that East Dorset is actually the least cut, and inner city at Liverpool has been the most cut. Now, the standard spending assessment, which decides what council should get, perhaps Tim will know more about this than I do, because it's based upon demographics and population and all these kind of things. But of course, a government can tweak that to help its own supporters. And I think we saw that in Oxfordshire, for example, when David Cameron was the Prime Minister, when they made a fuss about various cuts, then they were helped out. I'd just like to pick up what Tim said about the people voted for the Conservative government. 37% of people voted for the Conservative government, even though they've got a majority of whatever it is.
And I think it's 12.
I suspect many UKIP voters wouldn't be in favour of, who got one MP under our ridiculous system. Sinn Féin got four. I think many UKIP voters wouldn't necessarily be in favour of cuts to local government expenditure. So the idea that the right have got the mandate to carry out these cuts, I reject. And I think as a Liberal Democrat, you can understand why I'm saying that.
Well, this is not just you. I mean, your slight nod, Tim. Is that a nod or not?
No, I generally agree. We have a very unfair electoral system. My point was simply they're in charge. They make the rules of the game that we have to play within.
Yeah.
Earlier this week I spoke to Matthew Carey from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, and they're organising a protest tomorrow, so it's a bit of a march, but mainly a rally, so you can hear from all sorts of people that you don't hear from very often on the BBC, etc. You'll probably hear from the moron here, actually. I'm talking about local secretaries of trade union branches and that sort of thing. And that will be, I think it's, 11 a.m. Saturday on College Green, before having a little march to Broadmead, a protest outside the Council House from 5 p.m. p.m. And budget meeting. Oh, this is on the Tuesday.
Yeah, it's 11 o'clock.
Next week on the Tuesday, which is, just to make that clear, it's 11 a.m. tomorrow on College Green and 5 p.m. on Tuesday. But anyway, let's have a listen now to what Matthew Carey has to say about the sort of reason and the logic behind the cuts and the austerity programme.
If the government cuts expenditure, or if Bristol City Council cuts £100 million per year from their expenditure, that's going to affect the local economy, and that's going to affect the taxes that the central government gets. So it's a vicious circle. Austerity is just a political decision by the government and effectively by the Labour Party, which we oppose and we're campaigning.
Well, in what way is the Labour Party part of the austerity programme of the Tories?
Well, we believe it's a choice on their part as well, because it is possible, it would be legal for them to suspend the cuts and join us in the campaign against the cuts to try and end this austerity in 2017. So we, from our point of view, it is a choice by them as well as by the Conservative government.
Well, if you don't get your way, and I'm afraid that because you're not quite close enough to control the Treasury, you know, you're campaigning on the outside to do it,
yeah.
And fair play to you for that. But where is this going to end?
Well, I don't think it's going to end on next Tuesday, which is the council budget meeting, which is, I think, perhaps what the Labour Party are thinking, because we've been doing stalls all around the city and, you know, on the estates where these council services are really needed by local people, in Southmead, Hartcliffe, Florence Weston, Fishponds. And people are shocked when they hear about the services that are going to close, the customer service points, the libraries, the public toilets. All of these services, they're going to cut half the money from First Buses subsidy, so lots of bus routes are going to close down as well. And I think that when people hear the details of the cuts that are coming through, there will be massive campaigns and they'll have real political trouble getting them
but
through.
But Marvin will hold up his hands and say, sorry, it's nothing to do with me, it's all central government's fault.
Yes, he will, and that's what he's doing at the moment, but that's why we're trying to put pressure on him to change his mind.
How much is there in reserves that you think Marvin could use?
It depends how you look at it, but it's between 130 and 260 million.
A lot of people talk about Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour Party leader of protests and not really capable of running a government.
Well, I think that he faces a lot of opposition because his ideas go against the grain of the last 20 or 30 years in British politics. You know, we've had this neoliberal hegemony over the last 30 years, which says that everything has to be privatised, everything has to be cut back, that small government is good and globalisation is good. And that doesn't necessarily represent the interests of the majority of the population. And I think that what Jeremy Corbyn represents is that change. He represents the ideas that, if they were brought into the mainstream, would represent the interests of the
people. Many people say, even people in the Labour Party, some of them might even be our local MPs, say he's unelectable.
Yeah, well, those are the people that were you know, became MPs largely in that period that I'm talking about. You know, there was a whole 20-year period where people like me, socialists, wouldn't have been allowed in the Labour Party, let alone be allowed to stand as candidates. So that's why we've got to the situation we've got to.
Well, that's Matthew Carey there from Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Meeting at College Green, 11 a.m. tomorrow, and on Tuesday at 5 p.m. For the council's budget meeting. But Tim Kent from the Lib Dems here on Bristol City Council, the cuts before they've even been announced. There's a campaign been launched this week to save Bristol's Jubilee Pool in Bedminster. Swimmers who use a much loved pool in Bristol have launched a friends group to ensure the facility remains open when its contract ends later this year. People living in Knoll actually have launched a Friends of Jubilee Pool after concerns regarding the future of the facility. It's 82 years old. It's run by contractor Parkwood Leisure on behalf of the council, but the five-year contract to run the pool ends at the end of September. So people are already thinking, well, they're going to be closing our facilities.
Yes, and I'm joining them tomorrow midday at Jubilee Pool. We're holding our protest, so I hope people will come along. And next week I do have a budget amendment down to try to put some money back into Jubilee Pool to save it from closure. And it's one of the worst cuts, actually, because of the sneaky way it's been done. It was presented as a saving on a contract, yet hidden on page 180 of the 600-page budget documents were the words "closed Jubilee Pool." Nowhere near, of course, the front where the cuts were being listed. It was hidden in the middle of the document, so that was the actual intention. So we want to fight that. There are choices within what we are doing. Although government cuts are the main reason for this, and then also pressures on services, I think we do have to remember that about a quarter of the cuts are being are occurring because of a massive expansion in borrowing by the current administration. They plan to borrow an extra £450 million over the next 4 years to fund their capital programme. That actually requires you to cut £27 million from the revenue to pay for that extra borrowing. So there are issues, and I think actually we should relook at our capital programme, tighten our belts, actually question whether or not some of those schemes really have to go ahead in the next 5 years.
Well, which ones would you cut? About things like the arena. I mean, it's a bit of a bugbear of mine that that the City Council is paying for something which surely should be a commercial, I would have thought, be a commercial development.
Well, I've never been a massive fan of the arena. I've accepted, though, that others have strongly promoted the arena. There's always been an argument it would bring income to the city. I don't think that that argument stacks up. There is a separate argument that some of the arena costs are actually paid by a different funding mechanism, but up front we would face costs with the arena. At the moment, that is in the budget as costing us £18 million next year. That's actually £18 million we don't necessarily need to fund, but cuts are going to be made next week to fund £18 million for a project which has already been announced. This has been delayed by 3 years. So we've already found holes within the proposed budget, but unfortunately at the moment, what we understand is amendments are not likely to receive support. My final call to Labour councillors, and perhaps to residents who have Labour councillors, is lobby your councillors, ask them to support some of those amendments that they see on Tuesday. Together we can protect some frontline services.
Also, part of your portfolio is transport, am I right?
Well, I've certainly done transport in the past.
Yeah,
yes.
But I mean, the Metro bus, we can't really stop the spending on that. It's all happening, pretty much happened. How's things going on that?
Well, the Metro bus has massively overspent. A lot, not all of, but a lot caused by delay. I thought it was quite ironic we had George earlier talking about reviews. And if he hadn't reviewed Metro bus for 1.5 years, it might actually now be £10 million cheaper. That's the cost, by the way, of about 18 months delay to a £200 million capital programme. It looks like it is finally getting there after the chaos it's caused. I think once it's in place, it will begin
to improve
services. Which
will be when? When are we actually going to be able to start using this thing rather than just see it as a kind of way of getting in the way, causing roadworks? And I think I've talked about this with you before, but it does look to me as if the delays being caused by this thing are actually going to probably far outweigh the advantage once it's up and running.
Well, the delays have been pretty bad this year, like most people have been causing it. Let's remember the first route is delivered, the South Bristol Link. They haven't put the bus on it yet, but the infrastructure is there. The second route is getting there and will probably be finished by the end of the year. And also the Hengrove to North Fringe will be finished sometime nearish the end of the year, at least the southern phase will be. So it is getting there. There is still an issue of the fact that they have not got an operator to run Metrobus, and that is a real threat and a real issue, I think, for the new Metro mayor who will come in. And I think that should be top of their agenda, is to solve this Metrobus mess.
Could it possibly be First Group, because First Group were in charge of the horrendous tram crash down in Croydon last year, where it was pretty clear what was happening, although there is an investigation going on. The driver was driving this tram about 3 or 4 times the speed it should have been, and he tried to take it round a corner at about 60 miles an hour, which was designed for 20 miles an hour. So First aren't necessarily the right people to manage this Metro bus.
Well, First Bus dominate our local market. The reality is there's only a couple of bus operators locally who could run it. It does not mean, of course, that a new operator could not come in. I know that currently all the operators have refused to run it at no cost. They want a subsidy to run it. That is additional public cost. I think in the long term, the Metro bus routes will be profitable, but the short term, commercial operators are not willing to take that risk.
Is this why the existing route, the First route, which has already pretty much been built, is not being operated yet, simply because there is no one to operate it?
Well, to be clear, the actual bus element of that is only 95% built. The 5%, which finally links it into the Ashton Vale and then on, is not complete. So it can get as far as the park and ride at Long Ashton, but it can't get out of it. So so in a sense, that segment is finished, but it relies completely on the Long Ashton element to be able to complete its bus route.
Well, we've been talking a lot about local finance here. Sorry, folks, if you're not into the finance, but it's actually our money they're spending, you know. Let's just keep an eye on them to a certain extent. But Martin, let's have a little look at the national situation. Britain's national debt is poised to hit $1.7 trillion. We've got the budget coming up at Westminster. Obviously, there's the budget meeting here in Bristol next week, with interest payments approaching £40 billion a year. So this is where a lot of our money is going, folks. It's going straight to the banks, and nothing is really being done to stop this. A further £91.5 billion was added to the national debt mountain last year alone. So this is going nowhere but more and more and more money being paid to the banks in interest, Martin.
Well, interestingly enough that we're bringing this question of the national debt up, because we haven't been talking about that since George Osborne disappeared, have we? We were going to actually decrease the national debt, and we were going to balance the book, or the deficit, not the debt, of course. The debt's been there since the Napoleonic Wars.
Matt just mentioned the deficit on from...
Well, Bristol indeed, but I mean, the point is, what the current Tory administration, quite sensibly in my view, has decided that getting the deficit down is not the only thing that they need to do. But of course, the first administration, in which the Liberal Democrats took apart, took the view that we were definitely going to reduce the deficit to zero in one parliamentary term. In actual fact, the Labour Party, Ed Ball, said that's not viable. And you know what? They were right. It's not viable. You can't reduce it that quickly.
So, Tim, are we like rabbits in the headlights here? This is just going up and up and up, and we're just being told, yes, we've got a financial policy, but actually nobody's really dealing with it.
I think the problem we face is the decisions by governments in time immemorial who just borrowed and borrowed and borrowed. And I think really it was nearly criminal that during our best times we were still borrowing. And it seems like they had not learnt the lessons of the past, or even in the Bible, then the good times you save for when the famine comes. I do agree that I do think there's been a slight emphasis change in government. And to be clear, the coalition government wasn't about paying off back, eliminating the deficit within one parliament. It was two. It was the Conservatives who fought the general election campaign in 2010 said they would eliminate it in one parliament. The coalition stretched that to two. It now appears that the government is accepting it be at least three.
And they're giving up. Effectively, they're giving up, aren't they?
Can I come in there? Because it's not the only thing to do to reduce the national... if you try to reduce a deficit or a debt too quickly, you crash the economy, and therefore your tax receipts go down and you make your position worse. Now, we've got to tackle this, because people just think, oh, well, we've got to this debt, we've got to get it down.
Okay,
yes,
Martin,
in the long run,
okay,
you
Martin,
have.
What, but if you, what tra- would you, if you were Chancellor, what would you do then?
Well, first of all, we've got to knock this idea on the head that the only thing we need to do
we've
is get the
done,
deficit
we've just
down.
Done that, so what
okay.
would you do?
Well, having agreed that's not the be-all and end-all, you've then got to steer the car sensibly so that you don't just crash it by putting the brakes on. You can't just spend either, but on the other hand, I think there's a very strong case gradually emerging. If you're going to have zero interest rates, which we've had for 8 years, and a massive bubble in stock markets now, which is probably going to crash, but there's, at some point you've just got to say, well, if we've got zero interest rates, there is no case for governments not borrowing money to invest in stuff which is worth doing, as long as you can identify stuff that is worth doing. Now, we've actually got to get back to a balanced view of what the local and national governments' responsibilities are.
I
in
guess
this
you're
case.
Talking about things like building houses, rather
well, houses,
than,
indeed.
Rather than Hinkley Point.
Well, and rather than things like the arena, possibly.
Or in the arena. Anyway, what do you make of all this, Tim?
Well, I agree that one of the greatest dangers to our economy is the housing shortage that we face, and it's the failure of the housing supply market. It is the false constant increase in house prices, which is great if you own a house, but terrible for those that don't, and is dividing our society. I think in one sense that really should be a priority of any government of any colour, because the reality is it is going to cause a terrible crash within our economy if we do not deal with the house bubble. That, having said that, It is difficult to win the argument of where to build new homes. I'm a big supporter of new towns, garden villages. I think that's the way of the future rather than constant urban extensions.
Well, what they did up in Malmesbury, we had a programme over Christmas, if people want to go back and find it, with Councillor Simon Killane from Malmesbury, and he put together what they call Planning for Real meetings, a series of meetings in Malmesbury, and completely ignored who owned the land. He said, well, if we could build anywhere around here, including on old industrial sites, where would people like? And they said, oh, well, there's a few, we could put a little footpath there, it's quite close to the town centre, we could build there. So it was a kind of real blue sky thinking project. Now, the problem was that the existing big landowners didn't necessarily agree. And so there's been a bit of a civil war over in Malmesbury, with Simon being smeared, a smear campaign against him, hate campaign against him, actually, effectively by by these big landowners who already decided years ago where they wanted their houses to be. So there's all this kind of, all these sorts of problems through the planning system. But look, I mentioned Hinckley a minute ago there, and there was some crazy, I say crazy, 3,800 concrete segments to be built in Bristol for tunnels at Hinckley Point, apparently, this week in the Bristol Post. But I've been making a few calls this week about what's happening with Hinckley after this accident at Flamanville in France, because Flamanville is really a kind of test case for Hinckley. You've got a very similar situation with two existing nuclear power stations in Flamanville and one being built next to it. And honestly, I ended up, after making these calls, thinking Hinckley can't happen, because the problem being that Flamanville's got to be operating by 2020. It's also got to have been operating successfully for 6 months up until the 1st of June 2020 for any of the government's guarantees of money for EDF for Hinckley to actually for the money to actually come through. And it's now looking as if EDF is not going to get this power station running by 2020. Therefore, EDF are not going to get their money for Hinckley. Therefore, things are going to really kind of slow down, and Hinckley might never get built, Tim. This just sounds like a total... One person described to me, a former nuclear engineer, this as a slow-motion train crash.
Well, the Hinckley effect is even greater than that, because just to talk about what we were talking before, about some of the increased costs for Metrobus are actually tied to Hinckley. Hinckley is sucking so many people from the construction industry into Hinckley that we're predicting is not only current shortages, but shortages in the future, price increases in construction, in particular for house building in the southwest region because of Hinckley. I think actually, I think a lot of sensible people have grave doubts about Hinckley, whether it's from a safety point of view, whether it's from a renewable energy point of view, or whether it's from my viewpoint, which is it's just a massive waste of money, and that's not the way we should be spending our money on energy infrastructure. I was quite hopeful when Theresa May said she was going to review Hinckley. Clearly, they are looking to push ahead. I think you're right, this new nuclear, this fire at the nuclear plant in France may have a real effect on Hinckley.
Well, they've said that it was nothing to worry about. Of course, EDF over there, although they haven't actually released any information about what really happened, they've said it definitely won't be back online, this explosion. Fire is putting it mildly at one of the nuclear power stations at Flamanville. And there's all sorts of problems with the reactor pressure vessels, which actually keep us safe from some sort of nuclear accident. In Flamanville, they're saying that the steel is just not up to quality there, and therefore they're going to have to remanufacture these pressure vessels, which take years and years to build. The steel in some of the existing reactors, Martin, as well, in France, has been found to be under standard, and so there are scores of nuclear power stations now in France that EDF run that have had to be shut down.
Well, I think that's the killer thing is that it just doesn't pay. This is white elephant stuff, isn't it, effectively? And I remember writing a paper years ago in the 90s when they were talking about... No, it was in the 80s, about whether they were going to privatise the British nuclear fuels, and when and it was all being bigged up by the Thatcher government at the time, and then when the city had a look at the books and realised what they'd be letting themselves in for, the whole thing just went down the drain. It's only through public subsidy, direct or indirect, that you can have any kind of nuclear power. And of course in France they've doubled down on that over generations, and they're now stuck with the white elephant.
Yes, well, I mean, if EDF manages to survive itself until 2020 without going bankrupt, that would be a minor miracle. Anyway,
we can't really do this show without talking about Brexit, and I'm afraid we had the ghost of Tony Blair appearing on radio and television today. I don't know if they who it is that chooses him as a kind of chief of marketing. But anyway, look, he spoke to Bloomberg News about this, and I was just absolutely amazed at the way that the interviewer from Bloomberg News introduced Tony Blair. And here he is. I did see some quite amusing comments underneath this video calling Tony Blair the classic Remainiac. But anyway, here he is trying to sell the idea of remaining in the EU. And with a fascinating introduction by Bloomberg News's news anchor.
Mr. Prime Minister, good morning. I was quite taken by the emotion of your speech and your bluntness and directness. Our global audience knows the Labour Party of Blair, of Gordon Brown, of Alistair Darling, etc. And now it's become a jumble. Who did you speak for today? You didn't speak for today's Labour Party, did you?
Well, parts of it probably, but not its leadership, no. But I think, you see, this thing with Brexit is part of a much, much bigger debate. It's really about globalization. It's about what I would call the open-minded approach to the world versus the closed-minded. Now, the reality is that that distinction goes across traditional boundaries of left and right. The problem, though, and this is the problem, to be fair to the Prime Minister, she faces, and she's, you know, this is not an easy task, and I'm, at one level, deeply sympathetic to her about it. But the problem is, there are no easy ways of maintaining all those links whilst doing what the people on the right, who are really driving this agenda, the far right, want. So if, for example, you don't want people from Europe to come here, or you want big restrictions on them, it's very hard to reconcile that with membership of the single market. Right now, there is no way that the many millions of people who feel that this decision is wrong, and who particularly now think we are going down the route of Brexit at any cost, right? There is no way they can articulate their feelings. So what I'm saying is all these different groups in different political parties who are agitating around this issue are saying, come on, let's actually think what we're doing here, that we've got to combine together. And then, frankly, members of parliament who at the moment feel, look, okay, this is just going to happen, so what's the point of me speaking out against it? You've got to give them the strength, the courage, the protection, if you like, to be able to say, well, hang on, my constituents are now saying to me, we need certain guarantees about this, or my constituents are now saying to me, we don't like the way this is turning out.
Now, Lib Dem Councillor Tim Kent, I'm imagining you probably did vote Remain, and you're a bit of a Remainer. Are you a bit dismayed to see Tony Blair weighing in on your side in this discussion as this, what exact kind of Brexit we're going to get is discussed and decided?
Well, I'm a strong Remainer. I still think we should remain. But I will say my social media was full of comments about Tony Blair. So my Brexit friends were, who's he to lecture us? And my Remain friends were, oh my God, how terrible. We've now had to pull Tony Blair out. This is a disaster. So, I mean, I'm afraid with Mr. Blair's history, I do not think he is the right spokesperson for those who want to put forward a strong campaign for either a soft Brexit or a rethink and maybe Remain.
Are you as deeply sympathetic with Theresa May as Tony is?
Am I as deeply sympathetic with Theresa May? No, I'm certainly not. I mean, I personally think she's leading us to a course of complete and utter disaster in the long term. I strongly believe that Britain should stay within the European Union. I do accept that we've had a referendum, we've lost that referendum, and so I understand why she's proceeding partly the way she is, but I think this concept of a hard Brexit would be disastrous for our economy in the long term.
Well, I mean, the economy is going to be a disaster anyway, as far as I know, isn't it?
Well, it is not in great shape. It certainly didn't need this chaos.
Martin, what do you make of Tony Blair talking about the Brexit campaign actually being led by the far right, as you said there?
Well, we know there obviously are far right people behind Brexit who are, you know, frankly unsavoury and racist. But we can't presume that everybody who voted for Brexit is of that persuasion. I agree with what Tim said. I'm bringing Tony Blair out. I am a Remainer, and I'm rather dismayed that he's chosen to join into the debate, because it doesn't actually help us very much to make the cases we want to make. And I think as you mentioned a minute ago, Tony, there are the I mentioned earlier that the zero interest rate policy around the world is creating a huge stock market bubble. We've now got the Trump bump going on in the stock markets, where they really believe that he's somehow going to magically improve the economy. And of course, you've now got what Keynes and even George Soros recognise, that it's very hard if you're a fund manager to opt out of a bubble. You can't opt out of a bubble because you have to join in. If you don't join in, you're going to lose money and people won't invest their money with you.
Well,
that's how bubbles work.
We've had another sort of intervention this week, a sort of Brexit related, I suppose, and that's by the Aaron Banks, who lives around here. Is him talking about Hillsborough apparently sparked renewed fury for agreeing the disaster which killed 96 football fans, Tim, was the result of thuggery.
Well, it's just a disgusting statement, isn't it? And, I mean, UKIP have not been having a very good week around Hillsborough because, of course, their leader, who's standing in one of the by-elections in Stoke, has been outed.
This is Paul Nuttall.
Yeah, Paul Nuttall's been caught out claiming that he had close friends that died at Hillsborough, where that clearly wasn't... Well, he's admitted was not the case. I do not understand why somebody would continue to spread what is accepted by everybody now as a complete lie. You know, the Hillsborough disaster was not caused by thuggery. It was caused by very poor stewarding and policing and poor infrastructure and a complete and utter lack of care of the system. It was not the fault of the fans.
Also, we've had news this week from the courts, Bristol Crown Court. Tory councillor, we were discussing this last week while the case was ongoing, but now there's been a verdict, has been found guilty of being a rogue estate agent for a cannabis factory gang. Tory councillors found guilty for being part of an organised and sophisticated drugs gang turning homes into cannabis factories. Donald Hassett was accused of acting as a property fixer using a fake name and references to rent out houses used for growing drugs. The 56-year-old found guilty of conspiring to produce cannabis between January 2015 and March 2016. And Vietnamese Tan Tran of 7th Avenue Filton was also found guilty of the same charge as Hassett, South Down Road in Bath. The jury convicted both men on a majority verdicts in under 8 hours following a 2-week trial at Bristol Crown Court. This is a little embarrassing. Did you ever have any dealings with this councillor, Tim?
No, I haven't, because he was quite newly elected, so he was one of the...
But he's still a councillor, isn't he? Even though he's just been convicted as a cannabis factory, you know, manager, effectively.
He has not resigned his position from the council. The courts may step in anytime soon to resolve that, because I think the rules are, if you are sentenced to more than 3 months in prison, you're immediately disbarred from office, and that will cause a by-election. One would presume that, given the offence he's been found guilty of, that such a sentence is quite likely. But I've got to say, if the guy had any decency, I think he would put his resignation in first thing Monday morning to Bath and North East Somerset Council.
Martin, I mean, we did ask the Conservative candidate for Metro Mayor about this last week, but what's your thoughts about whether the Tory Party are doing due diligence when they're choosing people to be councillors?
Well, I'd rather take a different tack, which is that the whole laws about drugs are irrational and silly. And of course,
it's okay to grow.
No, it's not. It's against
cannabis
the law.
In a factory.
Well, if you think about it, it's growing cannabis locally in a factory is probably better than having it smuggled from Colombia, in which people are being killed on the basis of having it moved around the
world. So he's using false names.
I'm taking a slightly different tack. We can all tut tut. I'm trying to just bring out a different level of discussion here. It reminds me of the chap.
Can you answer the question I first asked you, which is, do you think the Conservatives are doing due diligence on the characters of the people they're choosing to be councillors?
I think the Conservative Party tends to be made up of people with sharp eye for business. And as long as you don't get caught, this guy had a sharp eye for business. That's the reality.
Okay, so how would you like to see the law change then
with cannabis? I just want to bring up something that might be of interest to our listeners. Tony Colston Hayter created the rave scene in the late 90s. He was an entrepreneur that started off by running things called the Gatecrashers Balls, which were for public school kids to meet opposite sex, because of course they tend to have single sex schools. And then he moved on from that to setting up the rave scene. And he actually was a right-wing conservative. That was his politics. He was a libertarian. and he was also a supporter of the Contras in Nicaragua and so on and so forth. He was rather horrified by the direction the rave team scene took once he'd created it, but he was the creator. And we've had Tories and UKIP, like various people on here, discussing this whole question of what are the appropriate legal things around drugs. And of course, in Latin America, across the political spectrum, people are really beginning to ask the question now, can we afford to carry on having illegal drugs, which leads to a situation where huge amounts of illegal money are sloshing around, basically propping up the financial sector. That's an open secret. That the financial sector
sounds
totally
like you're saying that this guy is ahead of his time, this Tory councillor, and an entrepreneur.
Well, I'm just pointing out that he is a small fry compared to the big boys who get let off. HSBC were convicted of money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels when Philip Green was their head of operations, and instead of being punished, he was promoted by David Cameron to be his main advisor on tax.
Also, apparently they made about 100 times more money out of that than they paid in a fine. Anyway, yeah. So anyway, Tim, what do you make of this particular case and how the Lib Dems think about the drug laws as they are?
We, of course, have quite a strong view that the drug laws need rethinking at. My view goes a lot further than that, and I think the war on drugs has been a complete disaster and left a lot more people drug addicted, has caused a lot more hurt and harm, and looking at drug use as a medical problem rather than a criminal problem.
If you had your way, this guy would have been just an ordinary businessman making a bit of money.
No, if I had my way, this guy would have been arrested for the criminal damage that he did to these people's houses. I mean, the reality is these houses were badly damaged when he put all his drugs equipment into the houses, and so quite rightly he's been convicted. So there are victims, one of them being, I think, a vicar in South Bath who was renting out a house to him, and I would imagine has had to pay several £1,000 to right the wrongs of the damage done to his house.
Okay,
can I just point out, Martin, if drugs were legal, then he wouldn't be operating in that way at all anyway.
That's true.
He'd probably have been running an industrial estate or something, wouldn't he? Okay, so final story this week, Bristol's resilience strategy. We were talking earlier on about needing reserves. We were talking about the possibility of a crash. Goodness knows, I mean, an accident at Hinckley, that sort of thing. This resilience strategy is what used to be called civil defence, if you remember that from years ago. I think it was the 1990s. They changed it around to something called resilience with the Civil Contingencies Act. And now we've got this whole kind of department at the City Council. It's one of the videos which is on the wonderful Bristol City Council YouTube channel, and I thought I'd take a look at this and I'll play a little extract from some of the people who are in charge of this strategy here in the UK, which I was quite interested to see. Involves private companies, of course. So we're going to hear now from Marvin Rees himself, the mayor, then Anne Cousins, who's the senior consultant at Arup, and then Sarah Toy, who's Bristol City Council. You've probably never heard of her, but she's Bristol City Council's senior resilience officer.
Well, resilience and this resilience strategy has to be the core or the foundations on which we build our city's future. So we want resilience to run through our approaches to health, business, the way we do our physical development, our education system. All that has to be built on resilience. It also has to be built, which I'm really pleased it's reflected in this, on that relationship between environmental justice and social justice.
So how's working on the resilience strategy shaped your thinking about resilience, Sarah?
I think more and more as we've gone through it, I've come to the conclusion that it's all about people, and that people are what form the fabric of a resilient city. I heard a great story about the oak trees in New Orleans post Hurricane Katrina that were the only thing that stayed standing because they connected their roots under the ground. And that for me is an analogy of how we need to be in a city, is people holding hands together and forming a strong fabric.
So, Tim Kent, you feel safe now?
I think this is a very badly named project. It comes out of a worldwide thing called Resilient Cities. It's actually about examining where we should be in 50 years' time, particularly around environment and transport. It is not actually about disasters, and I think they should rethink the naming of it.
Well, I think if it's about where we're supposed to be in 50 years' time, that's probably a good thing, but calling it resilience doesn't seem to be very sensible.
We'll see how resilient we really are. If anything does hit, I suppose Sarah Toy will be able to talk about that. We'll see if we can invite her in future weeks. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. After the Murdoch News, what's happening with our fire service? Will they be there when we dial 999?
And on your mobile.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the driver of a bin lorry which crashed in Glasgow, killing 6 people, has admitted reckless driving after an incident months later. Harry Clark had his licence revoked after passing out in the lorry's cab in 2014, but was caught behind the wheel of a car the following September. The White House says reports President Trump is considering using the National Guard to round up illegal immigrants are 100% not true. The Associated Press news agency says it's seen a document which discusses mobilising up to 100,000 troops. Irma Barrios lives in a neighbourhood in New York which was targeted in anti-immigration raids last weekend.
I'm terrified. Personally, my mom is undocumented. I have younger siblings. I have an older brother who can't really take care of himself. I'm personally terrified of the fact that I might have to lose my mom soon.
Tony Blair has been criticised for urging pro-Europeans to rise up and persuading those who voted to leave the EU that they were wrong. In a speech in London, the former Prime Minister claimed people voted without knowing the terms of Brexit. Tory MP and Leave campaigner Ian Duncan-Smith's not impressed.
You can't keep asking the British people again and again and again just to give you the right answer when you and a few of your elites actually want them to do that. The answer is get on with it, make sure we get the best terms Theresa May is trying to do, and stop keep harkening back to a better position that you think we should be in.
North Korea's ambassador to Malaysia says he will reject the results of a post-mortem examination on the half-brother of the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-nam was murdered at Kuala Lumpur Airport on Monday. North Korea is also calling for the immediate release of his body. One of the ringleaders of the Hatton Garden heist has pleaded guilty to his part in a similar raid in 2010. Danny Jones has admitted stealing goods worth £1 million from a shop in London. And eastern parts of the UK could be hotter than the Mediterranean next week. The Met Office says warm weather making its way over...